Welcome to the Best of Sales Skills podcast for our fourth year running. If you're just finding us now, welcome. If you're back from some of the earlier shows, well, thank you for coming back. As a reminder, this podcast is all about helping you secure and refine the skills we all need to be great at sales, with an extra focus on prospecting and outbound sales. I thought a good way to start the year would be with a guest episode from an interview I did very late last year. And the show that I was on was called the Investor Intelligence Podcast. It's all about intelligent investing. And it's hosted by a young man called Jacob Kearns. Nice guy. Great podcast. The reason I thought I'd start here is that the chat that I have with Jacob covers a lot of the fundamentals that we need to get right to allow us to be good at selling. And I think that's a good place to start the year off as we come back from our breaks, a good refresher if you like. And I also think that sales fundamentals are going to be really critical in order for us to get sales success this year. We're going to need to focus on the fundamentals if we want to be great. So over the last few weeks, if you haven't seen it, I've also released a Best of the Best series. And this is highlighting the very best episodes for 2023. So if you want a shortcut to finding four terrific pieces of valuable content, then catch the Best of the Best on your favorite streaming platform. So have a listen to those. All right, so welcome to 2024 and good selling. I'm Mark McGuinness, and this is the Best of Sales Skills Podcast.
Welcome to this week's episode of Investor Intelligence, your weekly podcast on all things investment, hosted by me, Jacob Kearns. Often when we talk about investing, we're looking for places to put our money where it's going to appreciate over time and give us more money in return. But today we're going to discuss investing in a different context. Many people know Warren Buffett as the most successful investor alive. He's worth just under $120 billion and is someone who's popularized the concept of investing in yourself. He stated that investing in things that are going to improve your education, skills, or talents can often have a better ROI than you could get from stocks or bonds. This is because skills can't be taxed, they can't be taken away from you, and they compound over time, meaning that the skills you invest time into learning today always be with you, increasing your ability to earn well into the future. With me today is a guest who's going to help us learn one of the most valuable skills that anyone could learn, and that is sales. We're going to start by discussing what sales is, why it's an important skill to have, and how it can be used even if you aren't in a traditional sales role. And then we'll discuss some of the more tactical aspects of selling and how you can go out and take control of your income. So with that, I would like to introduce my guest for today. He's the founder of the second largest sales agency in Australia. He's the author of Tactical Pipeline Growth, and he's the host of the Best of Sales Skills podcast. Welcome to Investor Intelligence, Mark McGuinness.
Thank you very much. Very pleased to be here, and hopefully we can demystify sales a little bit or make it a little bit easier for everybody. I love that piece about Warren Buffett, you know, about constantly learning and how that compounds over time. You know, one of my favorite references to that is Stephen Covey's Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. It's a book that's been around since, I'm going to guess the 90s, if not the late 80s, but it's at least the 90s. And the last habit is sharpen the saw, you know. And so rather than going to chop down a tree with a blunt saw, he's saying if you've got 4 hours to chop down the tree, you should spend 3 hours sharpening the saw so that you can chop the tree down in the most effective and efficient manner. And that's my version of that. I really like that, you know. So constantly investing in yourself is through knowledge acquisition. Love it. Well done, Jacob. Thanks for inviting me on.
Thank you. Yeah, no, I'm excited for this. So let's firstly discuss the philosophy of sales. So can you give us your outlook on on what it is, what it isn't, and any misconceptions that people often have.
Well, I think everybody knows the misconceptions, right? So it's the white shoed, you know, car, used car sales guy, insurance, like, you know, and that's where sales really gets a bad name. But it's sales is not that difficult when you break it down and you really have a think about it. And it's actually a really noble profession. And of course, you'd expect me to say that because I'm a lifetime seller and I'm a genuine fan. I do believe it's one of the best professions on the planet. The reason why it has such a bad rap is because when you go into a sales scenario, so if I wanted to sell you something, Jacob, say I wanted to sell you some microphones for your podcast, right? When I am preparing and when I'm going into that interaction, I'm thinking about what I want to get out of that, right? And what I want is for you to agree. Right? I want you to comply with my requests. So that makes me think a lot about how I can manipulate you or how I can get you to say yes, right? And we're all very conscious of the fact that no matter what it is that we do, in most instances, that's the way we approach sales. We're conscious of the fact that I need to convince Jacob to say yes to something in order for me to get what I want, right? So it feels like it's a selfish thing to do. But there's a very famous person who I guess you haven't heard called Zig Ziglar. Do you know a guy called Zig Ziglar?
Yeah, I do, yeah.
So he's got a saying that, you know, in order for you to get what you want, you first have to help everybody else get what they want. And I think this is a really nice way of thinking about sales. And what that means is, you know, if I help you get great sound on your podcast, and that's my focus, right, whether you buy my microphone or somebody else's, I remove myself from that outcome. Right, my goal is to help you get the best possible sound. Maybe you don't buy my microphone, but you buy somebody else's. Then that's not a selfish act, right? And so then I can enter into that conversation or that interaction, and my focus is just making sure Jacob's audio is the best it possibly can be.
Right.
And he's going to choose a microphone. It might not be mine, but it'll be somebody's. And if I can have a good conversation and give him some tips about how I can get a better quality piece of audio, then that's a win. So focusing on helping people get what they want, or, you know, to make that shorter, help people rather than sell people, makes it really easy for you to have a good understanding about what the philosophy, like sales, really is. It's hard to disconnect from the outcome when your salary, your house, your car is tied to the number of microphones. I don't know why I've chosen this as an example. I'm so sorry. But
that's good.
But you know, when your income and your lifestyle and your kids eating is tied to the amount of microphones that you sell, it's hard for you to overcome, you know, or separate yourself from the outcome. It's only salespeople who are very, very skilled or have got a lifetime of experience and a lifetime of asking and being rejected and people saying yes, that literally couldn't care because they've asked so many times, right? They don't care because they know at some point someone's going to buy their microphones.
Right.
So does that make sense?
Yeah. No, it's an interesting perspective, and I like the way you shift the perception and everything that I've learned and in my experience, you know, it's the people that genuinely have that desire to go out and help people, help solve their problems, that, you know, you can be the best salesperson in the world, know all the tools and tricks, but if you have that genuine desire to solve the other person's problem, then it makes life so much easier for you.
100%. You know, so like if you need to make some phone calls to talk to people to try and sell them something, it can be pretty confronting. But if you're going to call people up to try and help them with something, it makes it significantly easier. But, you know, industry, business makes it hard for you to have that focus because we're all driven by KPIs. We're all driven by the numbers of microphones that we sell and how much money we make off those microphones.
Yeah. And I think part of the challenge in the sales environment, whether it's calls going door to door, is, you know, asking the right questions to really get that understanding of whether the product or service that you have for them is indeed going to solve their problems. Is that typically what you find or how you approach these sales calls?
So we talk about conversations at the speed of trust, right? And what that means is in order for somebody to agree to something, you first need to have a conversation, and it needs to be a conversation, not a pitch. So my guess is that a lot of people get phone calls from, you know, energy companies or private health insurance, right? And literally they don't have a conversation with you. They just say, hey, do you have private health insurance? Do you want to check it? you know, like ours will be cheaper. There's no conversation there. So that's just a pitch. So that's a cold call that nobody likes. So creating a conversation at the speed of trust requires you to mix rapport and credibility, right? So rapport is, okay, I like you, I know you, right? Credibility is mark somebody that is worth listening to. So if you ring somebody up and say, hey, you know, I see you run a podcast. Look, just before I jumped on, had a quick listen. I really like the way Mark spoke about blah, 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 right? Your level of rapport with that person is going to be high because they've taken 5 minutes to do a little bit of piece of personalization, right?
Yeah.
So it doesn't take a lot of work to build that little bit of rapport. But then if you said, look, my guess is that you guys are probably using one of the recording platforms for podcasts, maybe you're using Riverside, or maybe you're using Zoom. What are you using? Right. Straight away, I'm starting to build some credibility because I'm using logos and names of the podcast that you would be associated, that you would know. So it's no longer a cold call, right? Because I've demonstrated a little bit of credibility by being able to show you that I know you. Okay. And then also a little bit of rapport. So rapport plus credibility equals trust. Once you've created a little bit of trust, you can have a genuine conversation about where do you record your podcasts, right? What sort of, you know, is it in, some people do it inside their bedroom cupboard because their houses are so noisy, they can jump in there with the clothes and the clothes suck up the sound, right? Other people do it in a studio. I'm lucky I can do it in my office because there's nobody ever in my house, right? Everyone's a little bit different, but you could ask some of those questions. And if you ask, you know, questions in the right way, people will know that you know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Right. And then once you have a conversation, you can find out whether Jacob actually cares about the sound quality of his podcast, because you know what? Maybe he doesn't. Maybe his boss has said, Jacob, you need to do 55 episodes, you know, a year, and that's part of your KPIs. And there's no KPI around how many people tune in, right? Mm. Yeah, but okay. but if your KPI is around how many people come back after listening the second or third time, you can say, did you know one of the major reasons why people stop listening to podcasts is because the audio is no good? You see what I mean? So by having that conversation at the speed of trust, having a conversation, that's then you get to understand what's really the drivers, and you can then help that person. Once they say, well, yeah, audio quality is really important for me, and I'm just using my Apple AirPods as audio, I thought that was good enough. You can say, well, because you said that audio quality was important, have you thought about looking for a professional microphone? Now you're starting to talk about microphone supplies.
Yeah, because you've got that problem through questions. So you're not trying to, you know, break their door down and just sell them. Like, you've already classified that they indeed have a problem that they want to solve.
But you wouldn't be calling people who didn't have a podcast about a podcast recording microphone, would you? Well, no. I would hope not. But the but the people that call you about, you know, private health insurance or about electricity, they call you regardless whether you have your phone, whether you're in charge of the electricity or not. They're just having a guess. So that's the difference between B2B and B2C.
When we spoke previously, you spoke about ethical persuasion and how that can be used in order to get someone to make a decision. Now, at this point, I assume it's in the point of the conversation where you've had that conversation with them already, you've identified their problem, and maybe they're having some trouble getting over the line. How would you use some of those techniques to get someone to make that decision?
So the assumption there is slightly wrong. So you can use ethical persuasion right at the very start of the interaction as well, right? So, for example, if you're reaching out, and I'll keep using the podcast example, it seems to be working well for us. Yeah, you know, we could say, hey, Jacob, my name's Mark. I'm calling you from Rode Microphones. You know, we speak to a lot of podcasters every week, and a lot of them are telling us that they're really focused on audio quality. Is that something you're concerned about? So what I've done there is use ethical persuasion of social proof. We talk to a lot of podcasters, and what they tell us is that they're worried about audio quality. So in your mind, right, you're going, well, if everybody else is worried about audio quality, I should be worried about audio quality as well, right? Yeah. So that is an ethical persuasion strategy called social proof. Ethical persuasion, also known as influence, is a really well-researched thing around human psychology. So it's about 80 years of research. Right, but it's not manipulation. It's basically the way that you frame a request in the same way that I just did then. Right, so if you know that you can frame a request in a way that's going to be more likely that people will comply or will say yes, then you know anybody that's in business should try and frame their requests in that way. But here's the trick, or the tactic, if you like. it only works to help the client see that they should move in a way that they like, they want to move, right? So in that example where I said lots of other podcast users are worried about audio quality, are you worried about audio quality too? You're not going to say no, or you're not going to say yes if you're not worried, right? No. So it just makes it safe for you to make a decision that you want to make, right? It's not manipulation. It moves people towards the decisions that they should naturally take. It makes it easy for them to make the decision.
Okay. Do you have any other examples on some techniques that could be
used? Yeah, so there's a gentleman called Dr. Robert Cialdini. So he's written a couple of books and he's considered the godfather of influence. He's very well respected and really well quoted. And he says there's seven principles of persuasion. So there's social proof, which I've already mentioned. There's reciprocity. So when you give something to somebody, they generally feel an obligation to return it. So if you and I went out for a coffee at morning tea and I bought you, you know, a cup of coffee at tea break, and then at afternoon we went back downstairs to the coffee shop, you'd feel obligated to buy the coffee for me. Yeah. And that sense of obligation, you can leverage that, right? So if you send somebody something and say, and create a scenario where it's perceived as valuable and delivered in a timely manner, then chances are people will comply to your next request, or they'll be more likely to comply to your next request, right? So why do waiters give you mints when they give you a bill?
The same concept, right? Because they expect you to tip more if they be nice and give you a mint.
Exactly right. The mints are worth nothing, right? But what they're trying to do is give you a little something. Or if you go to an Italian restaurant, they give you a limoncello, which is my favorite, you know. And you've ordered everything nice. And they go, oh, here's on us. And they go, oh, great, they've given us a free drink. We'll give them extra tips, right? So they're using reciprocity to try and, you know, get you to open your wallet, right? Mm. It's some tiny sense of obligation.
It's powerful stuff too, right? Like I've loved that book, Influence. And as soon as you read the concepts and those seven triggers, you see them everywhere, right? All the big brands and stuff using, but it works. That's why.
It does. Yeah, you're right. Everyone uses them because it does work. But most amateurs use them incorrectly. So they say, hey, Jacob, you know, I've been working with businesses like yours and what I'm hearing is, right? But when you hear that, you hear a sales pitch. You don't hear somebody that's been working with you. So instead, you need to make it feel more personalized, right? Hey, Jacob, I've been talking to a lot of podcasters based in Australia in the last couple of weeks, and what I'm finding is a couple of key things. Can I tell you about those? That feels like it's personalized, right? But what marketers and salespeople try to shortcut it and go, oh, let's just say other businesses, but it doesn't resonate. So they try to use social proof, but they shortcut it. In nearly every instance, when you use one of the ethical persuasion strategies, it's the long way round. So authority, reciprocity, which we spoke about, scarcity, you know, the toilet paper crisis. Like there was no shortage of toilet paper, but everyone ran out and bought toilet paper. Why is that? Because there was a perception of scarcity. That's persuasion. Mm. That's influence. We were influenced by other people around us buying in crazy fashion, and we felt that we were going to miss out.
Okay. I find this stuff really, really interesting. I love that book, and I've, you know, proven obviously that the techniques are very powerful. If you're interested, definitely go out and grab those books. The stats in those are super interesting. But with regard to your actual sales conversation, besides the example you just gave, how can you incorporate, it varies between which sort of factor or variable of influence you're trying to use, but how can you incorporate these principles into your sales?
Okay, so there's a couple of examples that I can share, and this is what I get my team to do. So if you think about negotiating time on your calendar, right? So everybody does this, right? So you're reaching out to somebody and you're saying, hey, you know, when's a good time? So if you say, and you just use scarcity, right? So if you were to say, oh, look, I can make time whenever suits, how valuable is that meeting to the other person? It's not valuable at all. So they think, oh, look, well, let's just take it on Tuesday at lunchtime. And then when they get to Tuesday and they think, I've got to find some space in my diary, who's the first person that's going to go? You are.
Yeah, well, you can book back in whenever.
Apparently, right? So instead, if you took the long road and someone said, well, you know, when can we get together? And you said, well, mate, I've got a couple of really important customer meetings on Friday and I really need to do some work for those because they're very important customers. But what I can do is probably make some time either early on Friday morning or Monday afternoon, right? They're going to go, oh, okay, yep, we'll take the Friday morning. Now, you may be able to move those other things in your calendar or that you've got planned in your mind, but by presenting it in that fashion, you're making your time seem like it's much more scarce and therefore more valuable. So you're going to get less cancellations. You're going to get less people move you.
Yeah.
Right? So that's just one tactic that anyone can do. But as a human, we want to be compliant. We want to help people. So we go, oh, look, whenever. But by saying that, you're actually increasing the chance that people are going to no-show on you because you're not demonstrating scarcity. The other one is any time you send something, you know, like a PDF or something like that in an email, most people would say, here's a report, have a read of that. How could you increase the level of value? How could you make it perceived to be more valuable? How can you make it timely and how can you make it personalized? So if it's an 8-page report, you could say, hey, Mark, here's the report from our latest analysis. So, you know, if this, and it was done by our head of data analytics, so you could create some authority around it. And then say, because we spoke about, you know, your desire to use ChatGPT, that's all on page 8. Don't worry about wasting your time and read the rest of it. Just go straight to the bottom half of page 8 and it's straight there. I know your time's valuable. Don't worry about reading the rest. Why? Because most people aren't going to read an 8-page PDF anyway, right? All you want them to do is engage with the piece that you want them to engage. And by presenting it as if you've done them a favor, you're creating a sense of reciprocity, right? I've done you a favor, but it's still the same PDF. It's worth nothing. But you've made it seem more valuable.
Any other tips?
Mate, we could go all day. But look, I think, you know, if people are interested, they just grab, you know, some of Cialdini's books and try and apply them yourself. You know, it can make a significant difference. It's the most important thing that I've learned in my time in sales is how to use ethical persuasion ethically, but to increase your level of compliance, to just simply get more yes to things like meetings, replies to emails, that sort of thing. Just makes your life significantly easier.
And how can people who might not be in a traditional sales role use these concepts to, whether it be in their day-to-day business life or just in their general relationships? How does this transfer?
Well, I think everybody wants more yes. Right. So, I use the word compliance because you're trying to ask people to comply. But, you know, we all have to negotiate things like, well, you know, here's my favorite use of it, right? My wife was a Brad Pitt fan, right? So she's mid 40s. I think every lady that's mid 40s is probably a Brad Pitt fan, right? I used to be in the army, I used to drive tanks. If I said to my wife, do you want to go and see a war movie? She'd be like, no, you go by yourself, I'll stay home, right? When Brad Pitt brought out Fury, right, he was a tank commander. What did I say? I said, honey, you still interested in Brad Pitt movies? What did she say? Yes. Cool. Yes. There's a new Brad Pitt movie on Saturday night. Do you want to go? What's it called? It's a tank movie called Fury. And she's like, oh, yeah, okay, I'll come. Right? So this is consistency, right? This is one of his persuasion strategies. So by getting her by reminding her that she likes Brad Pitt, I'm more likely to get a date and go to the movie than if I'd have said, do you want to come to a tank movie? Same question, but I've approached it in a different manner.
And I like, exactly. I like the sequence of which you asked her. If you jump down to, hey, you want to watch this movie about tanks, probably going to get,
Exactly. Right. So once you understand the concepts, you can then use it in all walks of life, and that will then give you confidence to ask to make these requests in your business life, you know, or, you know, when you're trying to do a deal, for example. All these things are important.
Another good one I've heard, Alex Hormozy, he says, use the example of going out to Chipotle. Hey, would you want to go to Chipotle for dinner? It's easy to say no to, whereas if you say, would you be opposed to going to Chipotle? Well, no, I'm not opposed to it. Then it's like, great, let's go.
Yep.
It's just, easier to say no to something than it is to say yes.
Yeah, and why is that important? Because anytime your girlfriend's a little bit different, you know, but anytime you're asking somebody to do something that they're not expecting to be asked, then default position is always going to be no. Right. So if anybody rings you up or sends you an email and you ask them, you know, hey, can I get some time in your diary? Can you forward this email? Can you go and get your CFO to reply to my email or, you know, you want them to do something? Their natural response is going to be no. So sometimes it works best if you understand that and embrace it, you know, and go, okay, well, let them say no. So it makes them feel like they've had a win, but we still get the result that we look. I mean, this is getting a little bit towards the manipulation side of things, but I think it's good for you to think about it from a psychology point of view.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting. But in terms of some of the more tactical aspects of lead generation and sales, what methods of client acquisition are you finding most effective in the current sales environment?
So look, this will be a little bit unpopular, but the telephone right now is really the most effective vehicle. And so we use email, social media, phone calls. We send stuff in the mail. You know, we send gambling chips that are customized. We send coffee cups. We send chocolates. You know, we send fake books. You know, a paperback with 180 pages that are all blank, and it looks like, you know, the person we want to speak to is written as the author.
Right? Okay.
And there's nothing in the book except it says, "Hey Jacob, you know, this story hasn't been written yet. Let's write it together, Mark. I'll reach out in the next couple of days." You know, and the cover of the book has got, you know, you written as the author, and you know, whatever the cover is designed to appeal to you, for example.
Interesting. I haven't heard that one before.
So if you're talking about high dollar value interactions, then it's worth the $50, right? So
yeah.
If the deal and the interaction is worth a couple of $1,000 or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars, then because the volume play is dead, right? So I don't know if people are across this, but you know, just in the last couple of weeks, Google have announced that they're going to clamp down on mass emails. So if your business sends more than 5,000 emails a month, if you have a spam count rate of 0.3% or higher, then it'll deprioritize your emails so that they won't land in people's primary inbox.
Right.
So this is going to heavily curtail a lot of email outreach, but it's also going to curtail, it's going to make it really hard for a lot of businesses to communicate with their customers because their sales team will be sending out lots of emails and the accounts team, who won't have any visibility in that at all, are trying to send their invoices with attachments, and Google will be saying, well, that's a bad URL. Send that straight to spam. And so all these people's invoices are going to end up in their spam folder. So we're going to see a pretty big change. And that's because people like Microsoft and Google are trying to clean up. They don't want people to move off email. They want people to use email forever, but it's becoming so bogged down that they have to, that starts in February 2024.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. I think it's getting harder and harder to not just reach clients, as you're saying, but also to personalize with new data laws from Apple. They really seem to be clamping down on the cookieless world, which means as a marketer or salesperson, you're going to have an increasingly hard time, one, reaching the right audience, by two, finding the right personalized messages to sort of show them that you have the service or product that they are after. So I think, yeah, it makes sense that it would be like that on the front line selling as well. If that makes sense.
Yeah. So it's very much about winding back the volume and going in on high quality outreach, you know, lower numbers, but you know, again, it's part of that conversations at the speed of trust. You know, maybe we ring Jacob three or four times over a week, you know, to try and have a conversation with him. There's a thing called the frequency of exchange. You know, the more I see you, the more I like you, which is, and even though we may not have spoken, you know, if you see my mobile number ring you two or three times and it's the same number, like eventually you're going to answer, right? And, you know, that's not the way scammers reach out to you, right? Mm. That's the way repo, because, you know, they switch your number. Every day they come to work, they get a new number.
Yeah, okay.
You know what I mean? Like they have like their office has voice over internet, VoIP systems, 100 phones. They come in and they get allocated the number for the day. They make calls off that. The next day they get a different number. So if I was to call you on Monday, then call you on Tuesday at 10 o'clock in the morning, then call you back at 11:30 on Tuesday morning, you'd be like, oh, that's that same 556 number. That must be somebody. Mm. So there's a frequency of exchange, right? So you might still answer that hesitantly. And sure, if I then say, hey, Jacob, it's Mark calling from Energy Australia. Just wanted to see what's going on with your energy. Then I'll get the same result, right? But if I then go, hey, Jacob, it's Mark McGuinness.
Oh, hey, Mark, how you going?
Yeah, and you know, so, but just any way that's different, right? You're going to be, hang on, what sort of call is this? Is this a,
yeah.
right? What's going on here? And that's what you want. You want people's mind to be open so you can have a conversation. So the worst thing that you can do is say, "Hi, Jacob, my name is Mark McGuinness. I'm calling from ABC. Have you got a minute?" Because what is that signaling to people? It's a sales call. Right? So the thing with this ethical persuasion and an extension of that is our brains look for patterns, for good and bad. And so anytime it gets the opportunity to recognize a pattern, it's going to jump ahead to make that decision. Right? So if you hear somebody say, "Hey, it's Mark McGuinness calling from XYZ," straight away you think this is most likely going to be a sales call. So if you want to reach out and have a conversation starting at zero, if you like, you know, like net neutral, just do anything but that. That's the answer.
Yeah. And I remember the last time we spoke, you mentioned that our brains are more wired to be receptive towards negatives in general. Yeah. Can you explain how that relates to all this?
Yeah. So, you know, my team and I make a lot of phone calls, and I don't mind telling you, you know, I'm always a bit hesitant to jump on the phones because I'm not on the phones all the time, but I make a few phone calls every day. And a lot of those phone calls are people I don't know, have never met. They're just literally somebody in my feed, right? I hesitate. But the reality is there's very few people will yell at you, but your body is hardwired to treat any negative stimulus as more important than the positive stimulus. So what we've started to do, and we've been doing this for a while, is create what we call confidence diaries, right? And try and record the positive interactions that you have on one file, and then on the other side, put the negatives. And what you'll soon see is that even when it's a bad phone call, most people are saying, "Mate, I don't think this is relevant for me. I'm not sure how you can help me," right? And you go, "Well, you know, blah, blah, blah." And they go, no thanks, but thanks. And most of them go, "Thanks for calling." Right? And then you go, "Oh, that didn't work because I didn't sell my stuff." Right? But instead you go, "Well, did I make a phone call? Yep. Did I speak to somebody? Yep. Were they receptive? Somewhat. Okay, so it's a tick, because I can't control anything on that side. All I can control is whether I make the phone calls and how I present myself on the phone, like how well I do at pitching. I can't, like, they may well have just bought whatever it is I'm selling. You can't control that, and you've got no visibility of that.
Yeah.
Right. So by saying a successful sales interaction is only from a meeting or from a sale, you're really setting yourself up for a tough life, because you're only going to get a certain amount of people that say, "Yeah, that sounds great. Let's move ahead." So instead, you need to look for the wins. Okay, did I talk to somebody? Were they polite? Did I get to talk about my product and services? Did I wrap that up in a way that was helpful to them rather than just a straight out pitch? Yes, yes, yes. Well, I've done everything. That's good. I'm winning. That's a win.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think, changing your measurements or metrics for success in this sort of setting would be, so important to your mental bearing on this sort of position.
Yes. And it comes back to that detaching from the outcome that we spoke about at the start, which is, and, you know, it's easy to say, but it's hard to do, because we're all, like you pointed out, you know, hardwired to the fact that, you know, any point of any negative stimulus carries too big a weighting. And that's done that for a reason, right? You step out in front of a car and the car blows its horn and you scare the poop out of yourself and your heart rate goes up and you're like, "Oh," but guess what? You don't step out in front of traffic for the next 6 months because you've been scared into compliance. That's what that negative reaction is designed to do, is keep you alive.
Yeah, it's interesting to think where that comes from in our brains.
Saber-toothed tigers eating us.
Yeah. Yeah, we're really not cut out for living in cities and talking on smart computers.
I don't think saber-toothed tigers were alive when we were. I don't know that for sure.
Yeah, I don't think they were. I don't know. I'm not a saber-toothed tiger expert. But no, I'm just thinking, trying to think of our business owner listeners. So if you had a small business or you're self-employed, how would you go about bringing in your leads or finding these potential prospects?
You've only got a limited amount of time. For those examples, the people that you've just described, they're busy, right? So you can't spend all day making phone calls or sending LinkedIn messages or sending emails, right? Because my guess is there's a whole bunch of other things to do as well. So you need to look for the most effective way for you to have the most valuable conversations you can have in a week or a day or whatever that time frame is. And I'll share a secret that works really well for us is we do a really good job, I think, of figuring out who is going to be a prospective customer, right? So we basically set meetings for third-party customers, right? So we do that for other businesses. So once we've figured out who that is, we then strip the data down and find who's in that group, you know. So for example, let's use that podcast example. So who's got a podcast in Australia that's still going and that they've delivered more than 20 episodes, right? Mm-hmm. That'll give us a couple of thousand people, I would imagine, tens of thousands of people. We can then figure out which ones of those we can get their mobile phone number. So we might end up with 2,500. We would then get somebody else, like somebody in the Philippines, or you can even do this with a little bit of technology, to call those mobile phone numbers to see who's going to pick up. Because not everyone picks up their number, their phone. So then we could end up with a list of 1,250 people who are running a podcast in Australia, have got more than 20 episodes, so they're likely to be long-term podcasters and focused on audio quality, and they pick up their damn phone. Mm. So then I can make 5 to 10 phone calls in an hour, and I'm going to get 3 or 4 of those people to talk to me. That's an effective way for us to have. And if you have 4 conversations a day and what you've got is valuable to the people that you're pitching, you know, or want to talk to, and you enter into a conversation that just, you know, like, what are you doing around audio quality, you know, blah, 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 like a conversation rather than pitching, you're going to generate business. So it really is, sales today really is about figuring out how can you have the most conversations with the least amount of effort, but to the right people. And if you can figure out how to do that, and it's usually a combination of technology and a bit of outsourcing, then you can drive your business, new business growth, with only a few hours a week.
Yeah, that's interesting. Are you getting these leads from lead scraping databases, or how are you getting that initial list?
So it depends on the client, because the data will live in different parts of the world. But yeah, so we have a number of list suppliers. So some of the list provide, you know, so Dun & Bradstreet was, you know, one of the ones that a lot of people knew, but, you know, Zoom Info is another one, Apollo, Lusha. There's a whole bunch of corporate players that will charge you to get access to lists. But and we do that in-house because that's a big part of what we do. But if you're a small business, you can probably buy some of these lists or outsource, you know, this to some businesses that might be based offshore, for example. Like, you know, so you can get anybody in the Philippines or in another area to try and create these lists for you and then test them and then just give them back to you. The error rate will be higher than if we did it, but it's still going to be better than you just calling a list of people, you know, and not knowing whether they're going to pick up, whether the phone's number's correct or et cetera.
Okay, we'll talk about you and your business and how you can potentially integrate to your clients. But before we do that, do you have any advice for someone who is maybe a business owner or looking to go out and take charge and start generating their own income?
Yeah, so I mean, sales is going to be the lifeblood of that scenario, right? So without revenue, you can't do anything, right? So nothing happens until somebody sells something. Depends on the style of business, but tech businesses, you know, software businesses and that sort of thing, the owners are traditionally pretty bad at selling, or they don't want to be seen as a salesperson. But the businesses that do really well are the guys and girls who have got over that hurdle, you know, and there's no easy way out. You know, like, what you need to do is have some accountability where you're saying, okay, I want to have 3 conversations a day or 15 conversations a week or whatever it is, and then just hold yourself accountable and then continually look for ways that are going to be make it more, that process more efficient. So whether it's that one that I just described where, you know, there's obviously a bunch of research and a bunch of work gone into that, but it means that those phone calls that you're making are going to be much more likely to be targeted and people are going to answer and you're going to have a good conversation, right? Well, once you've got that, just, you know, how many conversations do you need to be having every week? And then if those conversations aren't converting, well, then you need to improve the quality of your conversation, right? But hope is not a strategy. And a lot of people use that old cliche, you know, if you build it, they will come. And, you know, there's plenty of really great products and great ideas that just never got off the ground because nobody was around to sell it.
Yeah. Okay. And what would you suggest is the best way for someone to learn and get out there?
So I think that, the best thing you need to do is just figure out how you can have as many conversations as possible. And if you're nervous about that, then start making conversations in general, not just conversations with prospects, your target. So I'm 54. I know a lot of the people that are younger than me would not naturally pick up the telephone and have a conversation. If you're selling something that's even a little bit complex, you're going to need to be able to have a conversation. So, instead of texting or, sending an email to their business that you want to try and buy something off or you want to inquire about, pick up the phone, and get really comfortable navigating and negotiating with somebody else. And it could even be if you're just trying to figure out what their open times are and if you can place an order over the phone and then pick it up later, rather than sending, it's easy to send the text message or the email, but if you want to be good at business and you want to generate revenue for yourself and you want to make a living, then those types of conversations can be a really good pathway, like kindergarten for sales, right? Because at the end of the day, the person who, the leader, the business owner who communicates the best and can take people with them is the business owner that's going to be the most successful, because you've got to sell your staff. You've got to sell your suppliers. You've got to sell your customers. And that all comes from communication.
Yeah, no, when you put it like that, selling really is a part of nearly all conversations that you're having, really.
Yeah, and then wrap them in those persuasion strategies.
No, I think this has been a really good conversation, not just for business owners, but also anyone in their profession to sort of get a gauge on how these results-driven communication skills can benefit their lives. Do you have any final... I know you've mentioned a couple of books already, but any other favorite books that come to mind?
So what have we mentioned so far? Cialdini's Influence.
Cialdini's, yeah.
7 Habits of Highly Effective People.
That's it. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Persuasion by Cialdini is also really good. I like that. That's probably my favorite out of the two, PRE-Suasion. It's hard to go past How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie. I think that's mid-80s, but it's still pretty good. And two others, Pitch Anything by James Clear. Pitch Anything by Oren Claff, beg your pardon. That's a really good one for business owners. That talks about, he helps raise VC funds for a living. So, and he talks about how he pitches those deals. Brilliant. And then most of the things we've been talking about have been about behavior change, right? And in order to change your behavior, the best book to help you do that is a book called Atomic Habits. And that was, I just said his name, I've forgotten already.
James Cleary.
James Cleary.
James Cleary.
Yeah. And I don't know how many books that is, but that's more than one. So,
yeah. Awesome. And for business owners, do you work with who? What sort of business owner do you work with? To reach out.
Yeah. So, we typically help small and medium sized businesses that are looking to scale their sales. And we do that by setting appointments for either the business owner or for the sales team. We work only in B2B, so we don't do any B2C stuff at all. And we have a pay-per-meeting model. So you just basically pay per meeting that we set. And that's because we do it that way because we think we know what we're doing. And so that gives the business owners a bit of comfort, rather than paying, a $10,000 or $15,000 monthly retainer and not being sure what you'll get off the back of that. Instead, we charge by the meeting.
No, I think that's a great way to do it. And as you said, most business owners don't have the time to be doing this stuff themselves. So it's a really good way to integrate, get the benefits of your team's expertise.
No problem. So if people want to reach out, they're more than welcome. LinkedIn's probably the best channel. So if you have a look there, Mark McGuinness, pretty easy to find, I would hope. So
yeah, we'll put a link to that in the description as well. But I appreciate you coming on, Mark.
Mate, thank you very much for giving me a platform to talk about sales. I love it. Probably could have gone for another 2 hours, but we'll save your listeners' ears. Thanks, Jacob. I really appreciate it.
No worries. And we'll link to your regular podcast as well, which has some great information on there too.
Thanks, Jacob.
Thanks, Mark.
If you found this episode or any of our episodes helpful, please make sure to share and leave a rating to help us reach more people on their investing journeys. And of course, subscribe to be notified when new episodes drop. Make sure to follow the podcast on Instagram at Investor Intelligence Podcast. You can find links to our other socials in the show notes, including a link to the Property Mentors weekly blog. If you are ready to get your property portfolio in shape for financial freedom, check out Luke's latest book, Property Fit. You can get yourself a copy at www.propertyfitbook.com.au.